For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What is up, everybody? Thank you all for joining me in the latest CSG. And I would like to introduce a man who actually has not been on this podcast for about 3 years now. But he has been on my other podcast, The Gen X Show, where we talked about the Rolling Stones. But that's not important, because I have the very distinct privilege of having a man who is the MVP of the 1993 Rock and Jock Basketball Challenge, and a man who knows his shit about some of the stuff we're going to be talking about today. It is drummer extraordinaire, author, and more importantly, my friend, Steve Gorman. Hello, sir.
I think it's important to stress that I was a co-MVP of the 1993 MTV Rock and Jock Basketball Game, along with my teammate, Mark Jackson.
Mark Jackson, that's right.
We shared that honor.
That's right. Was Dan Dan Cortez on that? Is that one?
I believe he was. Yeah. There were a few people playing. There were some people that were really big at the time, but I had absolutely no idea who they were.
Oh,
you know, I could just tell the way the crowd was reacting. I was like, that guy must have a big movie out or a TV show, but I didn't know who anybody was. I was the first half of the 90s I was in a bit of a bubble. My coach was the coach of my team was the what's her name? Tiffany Amber Thiessen. Thiessen. And I had no, I mean, I was like, I've never even heard of this person. And people were freaking out that she was there. It was kind of funny.
That's amazing. I was just, and my distinct memory of that was like stumbling on it. Cause I was flipping through the channels and I'm like, oh, that's Steve Gorman. And he's just being introduced. Like, oh, that's pretty cool. And so that's the only reason I stayed. And then of course, then I hear Chris's voice doing color or something like that while that thing is going on. It was like the most surreal experience. But
he wasn't going to be there. He decided, like, I mean, we were literally on our, like, a car picking me up at my hotel to drive me down to Long Beach. I was in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
And he called my hotel room and he's like, hey, is that game today? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I want to go. And I was like, okay. And he goes, come and get me. I'm like, no, you figure it out yourself. And then he showed up and they put him on, but it was just funny. Cause I was like, what are you doing here? But it was a good day. It was fun. I met Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that day. So it really didn't matter what happened after that.
I was going to say, he's your basketball hero, right? Isn't he?
He's my number one draft pick in the all-time draft for sure.
Yeah.
So it was pretty, that was shocking to just walk out and like, oh, there he is. He's taking part in a fun, bunch of nonsense, and just said hi, shook his hand, had a moment of chit chat, and that was it. But yeah, it was awesome. I was astonished to meet Kareem.
You know, we have talked about this before, but my memory of Kareem is that the end of his career. And I do remember distinctly his last game, which was the sweep at the hands of the Detroit Pistons in the 89 finals. And the forum crowd shouting his name Kareem over and over and over as the, you know, the Lakers were just annihilated in that series. But that's my distinct memory of him, that and my dad getting upset that he was a surly bastard and stuff like that. But
well, I still can't let the word annihilated go without mentioning that both Magic Johnson and Byron Scott were injured. So you take away a starting backcourt from anybody, they're going to get annihilated. I still feel the need to defend that team.
That's true. And they ended up back in the finals 2 years later. So
They did. And for one brilliant night, they looked like they might win it. And then Jordan got one game in the finals under his belt and went, oh, okay, never mind. I got this.
Yes, I believe the game they won in the 91 finals was the AC Green game.
Yeah, it was game one, and good night, Irene, after that.
After that, it did not go well. So you are now in a city after, you know, being in Tennessee for a long time. You're now back in a city that has a professional basketball team, the Minnesota Timberwolves.
It's great. I'm not going to anywhere near as many games as I would like because I do have a very early wake up. But I'm at the very least, I get up and watch the highlights, you know, the next day. I keep up with the team. And I haven't had an NBA team in forever. Like, I've watched the league. I like the league. I grew up a Lakers fan, an obsessive Lakers fan. And in the late 90s, actually, when they got Shaq is when I sort of lost interest. I just didn't care for Shaq. It's funny. I love the guy now. I didn't like his press conference when he kept mentioning all of his sponsors. I was an old man at 30. I was like, this ain't right. You know, they were signing him to a deal. They announce him and they said, Shaq, how many rings do you going to win? He said, I just want to be young, have fun and drink Pepsi. And I swear to you, when he said that, I said, I'm off. I'm done with the Lakers. And I missed a few good teams there because of it, but you know, what are you going to do? I moved to Nashville in 2004. And so I got to a city for the first time in, at that time, almost 20 years without the NBA. Right. And looking at it now, I've really enjoyed it because I haven't been living and dying for any one or two teams. I've just enjoyed watching the league, especially the last, you know, 15 years. Mm-hmm. I've just had a blast with it. So, but to be in Minnesota now, you know, I mean, I'm not like walking around like I'm a Timberwolves fanatic, but I like the team. I genuinely do. And they're just absolutely a blast to watch. So I'm thrilled.
It's really cool because like you and I've known each other for about 4 years now. And one of the things, the thing we talk about the most probably is basketball.
Yeah.
And occasionally my awful, awful, awful Broncos and the recently down on their luck Tennessee Titans. So,
man, it's been a rough slog for my Titans, man. No question about it.
So before I get to some basketball talk, let's talk about that for a second. Are you a Will Levis believer?
I don't know yet. I'm a Will Levis hoper. I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Nothing would make me happier for him to come out and just, you know, light it up this year. He's certainly got a gun, and he's had a couple of bonehead moments off the field, which I can certainly understand. We all have. If you're going to be the man, that's got to stop right away. I'm an old school guy when it comes to my quarterback. I don't want any drama. Just, right. I don't want you to have a life. I want you to be a quarterback every day of the year. And I want you to just say the right thing and be boring as hell. I don't want controversy. I just want you to go light people up on Sunday. But he's got a year to prove it now, or at least a good part of a year to prove it. He's going to go into camp with that chance. So, man, I'm certainly hopeful that he steps up and does the job.
So this is going to be after Vrabel. AV. So it's there.
Yeah. I was really bummed out about that move. Although, you know, the new guy looks to have a great pedigree and nothing beats, or there's nothing worse than sitting around complaining about something you have absolutely no say in or control over. Vrabel's going to be fine. He'll be coaching somewhere a year from now. And he'll probably do very, very well for a long time. I think he's a great coach. I think that, you know, just simply put, the injuries, what that team endured the last 3 years to be even slightly competitive is a kind of a miraculous thing. I mean, clearly there's something in the water with the training staff or with the team doctors. They had more starters for three straight years than any team had ever had in NFL history. It's ridiculous.
Wow. I'm surprised New England didn't snap him up, to be honest with you. That seemed natural.
It's kind of seemed like that. I don't know. There's a lot of, I haven't really heard anything lately, but a month ago, everybody was just insisting that, that Jerry Jones is going to run what's his name in a year, and Vrabel's got the inside track for the Cowboys, but we'll see.
McCarthy, but that would be a smart thing to do, Steve. And
it would be a smart thing to do. Not for Vrabel. I can't imagine any coach wants to go work for Jerry Jones.
No.
If he's got options.
No, this is very, very much true. I mean, even Bill Parcells went to the Dallas Cowboys. So I'm sure he regrets that. But then it produced Sean Payton, who was an assistant there under Parcells and who is now the coach of the Denver Broncos. You and I've talked about this, how you're right. Payton should have waited a year and just got himself Herbert with the San Diego Chargers or the Los Angeles Chargers.
That's all right. They're forever the San Diego Chargers. Don't kid yourself.
They are to me.
I mean, they will never play a home game for as long as they're the LA Chargers. It's never, ever, ever going to happen. They're never, ever going to have more people cheering for them than whoever they're playing.
No. No, there's a reason there why football didn't go to Los Angeles for 30 years. Cause it's, you know, it's people, I believe you lived in LA for a while and I've lived in LA for a while. One thing I lived in LA in the early 90s and I'll tell you this, this is the only city in the country where NFL is a distinct number two, sometimes number three. And that is the only city in America. You could probably say that. People are crazy about the Lakers out there, and it's the Lakers and then the Dodgers, like distant second, and then everyone else. And it's the only city like that, only major city like that.
I know. I was astonished when I started hanging out there a lot in the 90s. I was a Lakers fan as a kid, but I bought the narrative that they were fair weather fans and Celtics fans were real fans and Knicks fans were real fans.
Right.
And when I got to LA in the early 90s, not living there yet, but when I was just in town a lot and I went to a few Lakers games, I was like, man, this is such a joke. These people are obsessed with this damn team. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Lakers fandom runs so deep. And when I lived there, it was, I lived there 2002, 2003, 2004. So it was Kobe, still Shaq Kobe. And I mean, playoffs started, every car in town has a Lakers flag flying, you know, it's crazy.
Yep. Second biggest city in the country, and it's basketball crazy, and which is probably why everything favors the Lakers in terms of coverage and stuff like that, because it's natural. It's like the biggest market, and that's, well, second biggest, and that's the way it happens, you know? And look, I'm a long-suffering Nuggets fan who finally is no longer long-suffering, to be quite honest.
I tell you, hey, man, if that team had stayed healthy, you'd be sitting on three in a row right now.
Oh, my God, I know. We go that 2021-22, right, when Jamal got hurt, I was, oh God, it felt like,
I mean, ever since the bubble postseason, you know, when everybody finally got a real look at them, and oh my God, there were some of them, those were such exciting games, and my son and I were watching all that together, and just, you know, we're both just sitting there going like, this team is just ridiculous. You could just feel it, like, man, if they stay healthy, they're all over it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and look, I don't know how they're going to do this year. In the playoffs, they're not as good this year, but you know who's good is the Timberwolves. And that's one of those things. And Tim Connolly, my buddy, is Tim, I know you're listening to this, so hello, and hopefully you and Steve can meet up at a basketball game. But there is just an ability for Tim Connolly to build teams in different ways that has been demonstrated right now.
Because
he did it through the draft with the Nuggets, and he's just moved pieces around with the Timberwolves in a just what I was just talking about this with someone else today. It's kind of almost a genius way how he's built this team designed to be very competitive and go stand toe to toe with the Denver Nuggets very specifically.
He knows more than anyone exactly what he's up against. It's been great to see. I mean, for as much grief and deservedly so as the Timberwolves got for the trade at the time, the Rudy trade, talk about making lemonades out of lemons. Holy shit. When they're on their game, I mean, I can see them taking Denver 6 or 7 games easily. Yeah. I'm not going to believe that Denver won't be in the finals until they're not. That's still the safest bet in the NBA right now.
Right.
But that said, boy, it's going to be a tough out. The Timberwolves will be.
Yep. And the you got to love Anthony Edwards out there. I mean, this is the guy's exciting every time he touches the ball.
I mean, I moved to Atlanta in 87, and that was still prime, not even prime Dominique. You know, it was just entering his prime. And I keep hearing people say Ant-Man reminds them of a young Jordan, and not with the all around game. No one's suggesting that, but just the intensity and just the moments where he does things where you recognize, oh, he's different than everybody else.
Right.
And that's what I used to think watching Dominique too. I mean, Dominique and Jordan at the same time were hitting their athletic primes, and they were doing things where you'd see it and go, no one else can do that.
Right.
And that's what Ant-Man has right now. And he's only 22. And he occasionally, I mean, the dunk last week, the one that everybody will show forever.
Jeez.
You know, it's just imagine being on the receiving end of that. I mean,
oh my God.
If you're on the other team, much less what's his name?
John
Collins staying under the hoop. You know, you're just, those guys know better than you and I. Oh, this kid's different.
Oh, we knew last year in playoffs.
Yeah.
It was just, there was something, and the Nuggets to a T, the players to a T, all said the toughest series they had was against the Timberwolves. And a lot of that had to do with Anthony Edwards. And I am just impressed. I mean, I think he's still, I probably said this to you once before, but I've said it in other places. He's got the youthful knucklehead thing in him still. And I think once that goes, I think the sky's the limit, because if you have a player like that on your team, like the Nuggets have with Jokic, it makes everything easier.
I think if he, it really comes down to what does he want to do in his off seasons. You know, he is just 22, but he's been in the league now long enough to recognize he's clearly had enough conversations with LeBron, with KD. You know, the older guys all recognize who he is. You know, they've all reached out to him. They've all said, hey, here's my number, kid. You're one of us. You know, that's happened the way it always happens. The question is it going to occur to him that if I literally work as hard as I can possibly work at this, you know, I can be a legacy player. I can be a Hall of Fame player. I can be a top. I don't think it's crazy to say he's a top 25 player of all time if he just works hard, if he works exceptionally hard, and if he goes Kobe, if he goes MJ or Kobe or LeBron with his off-season regimen, there is no limit to how far he can take his game.
Oh, absolutely.
The tools are all there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And sometimes you just know.
I mean, it's crazy. It's just crazy when you look at the level of athleticism in that league and the idea that people still show up and they're clearly a step ahead. It's like Randy Moss, you know, like that. Well, how is someone so far above everyone else on the field? And you know, it's just, there's a Brazilian kid. There's a 17-year-old Brazilian player right now, who's going to go to Real Madrid next year. His name is Endrick, Endrick.
Okay.
He's literally the greatest 17-year-old soccer player ever from Brazil. Think about what that means.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. How is that possible? How in 2024 is there still someone better than any other 17-year-old's ever been? All of the players, everybody, consensus opinion in Brazil is this: no one's ever been this good at 17.
Wow.
And it's just so astonishing that that still can happen. So anyway, I mean, I'm kind of getting out there with this, but that's where I look at Ant and I say that he's 22 and there's nothing he won't be able to do if he just decides it's worth putting in the work to do it.
Well, a brief aside here for people who are listening to this, Steve's a big Arsenal fan. And this being a fan of Arsenal is appreciated by, you know, all those of us who like our teams owned by Stan Kroenke.
It's the one thing he's gotten right, at least. I mean, like, I think pretty much his son runs it and he's done her. Well, they put the right people in charge. They got Adu and Arteta are the people to, you know, they've got the right guy calling the shots. They've got the right coach and they're clearly staying out of the way and not mucking it up. So as long as that lasts, I'm fine to withhold any bad words.
Yes. Well, I tell you what, I for the most of the time that he has been the majority stakeholder in Arsenal, I have received emails from very, very, very angry people in London.
Yeah.
Who do not like Stan Kroenke. And
the thing a lot of people miss, like Arsenal was one of those, for anybody that doesn't pay attention to this stuff, you know, they're one of the big four for forever. And they hit such a dry patch, not coincidentally, right after they moved to their new stadium in 2007, 8, 9. You know, they were just still good, but then they hit a really bad spot. And the truth is, they had to pay for that brand new stadium. They had to come up with a business plan. There was no way that they could afford to keep up with the signing wars once all the billionaires were buying the other teams, like Man City. You know, even Newcastle now has billionaire Saudi owners. They're able to just write blank checks. Mm-hmm. And Arsenal didn't do that. But, you know, it's funny because it just comes down to, do you know how much land costs in London? Do you know how much it costs to build a stadium in London, England? It's like, you know, it's a miracle the team is, it's not, but it's in one way, it's like, we're lucky they still exist. They pulled off the impossible. They built a brand new stadium in central London and were able to afford to stay there. And now they're back and they're in for the second year in a row, they're right at the top of the table in April, and it's exciting and it's great and it's all fine. But you know, they had a full decade in the weeds before the last couple of years. That's been just gut wrenching. But you know, you look at the name of the owner and look at the results right now, and you can't complain too much anymore.
Man, from the Rams to the Avalanche to the Nuggets to the Arsenal right now. I mean, they mm-hmm. hit on quite the streak right now, which is fairly amazing. I don't think.
Well, I mean, it's not that often that you see owners have so much vitriol sent their way, but then succeed. They don't ever pull out of that death spiral. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the owners that fans, you know, like Mark Cuban came in, made a splash and immediately made the Mavericks matter. You know, he was relevant.
Right.
It's like Kroenke did the exact opposite. You know, he just came in there and just made everyone sick to their stomachs. And then everybody, you know, like, oh wait, don't look now, but all of his teams are winning. How'd that happen? That's, you got to give him credit for that. I mean, I guess you have to give him credit for that. It still doesn't sound right to say.
I don't know. I mean, I don't, you're like me. I don't like complimenting billionaires, but it's,
no,
that's not part of my way of viewing. But I think that in a sense that as a sports owner, he's been very smart with this and he has let Josh run it. And Josh has done he spends most of his dedicated time with Arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's made a good choice with that because I think he's put the right people in place out there. From what you're saying, which is good.
Oh, sure.
That's the key to it. I mean, we have the example of terrible owners out here in Denver with the Dick and Charlie Monfort, who own the Colorado Rockies. So it's the opposite end. So a good owner can do good things and a bad owner can like just cripple your team. It is what it is in sports.
It's just so painful. You know, my Baltimore Orioles just sold to two new Baltimore natives, head fund manager, billionaire guys. And, you know, the Angelos family was much maligned by Orioles fans myself included, the longtime owner Peter Angelos was just like the devil to so many fans 5 years ago, and he had a couple of big PR gaffes last year, which is really out of character for him. He's a really bright guy, really perceptive guy, got a good heart. He had done everything right and then had a couple of real blunders, just PR stuff, dumb stuff that I would imagine he probably goes, I don't know why I did that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he just sold the team, and he sold the team in the best position they've been in 30 years. You know, they won the AL East last year. They, with the youngest team in the majors, they won their, the Norfolk team won the triple, they won the AAA championship. I mean, their farm system is jacked right now,
right,
with young talent. And now they've got, you know, billionaire ownership that wants to spend. And so, you know, for everyone ripping on Angelo's family for 30 years, you can say this, they certainly left the Orioles in a, and they got a 30-year lease at Camden Yards. Like, they cannot be moved. Everybody was worried about that. Hell, I've been hearing in Nashville for 5 years. The Orioles are coming to Nashville. That's been on the word. That's been the word for 5 years in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's always the Orioles. And I'm sitting there going, you guys are crazy. Like, you think Baltimore is a hard town now? That city will burn itself. They will self-immolate if the Orioles move. It's not happening. But they locked in for another 30 years at Camden Yards. And he sold the team to local grown billionaires who just want to win like crazy. So, yeah. You know, So again, like the ownership thing, it's a long game. And I do know that John Angelos, all he wanted was to do right by the team and the fans. And he certainly did that. If not always at the end, you know, the final chapter of the book's the most important chapter. So, I think he did a lot of damage control for his father's legacy.
Right.
Yeah. And similarly, you know, like you said it, you know, the Nuggets are winning, the Rams are winning, Arsenal's winning. It's kind of like, what else do you want as a fan of a team? You just don't want your owner to screw it up. Imagine being a, you know, for all those years being a Redskins fan with Daniel Snyder, who's just a complete sociopath idiot.
Oh my God.
A fan base that's as rabid as any fan base in any sport in the world. Boy. And they just had to sit there year in and year out and watch this guy just piss down their legs.
Yes, over and over, just without regard too.
Awful. Awful.
The what maybe the worst owner in professional sports, although I don't know
the worst people, man, the worst people.
The NBA had two of them.
It's funny because they did. You know, there's a reason. Like a guy like me isn't a billionaire. you know, it's like there's just such a chip missing in so many of those guys. You know, I mean, ownership's tough. You know, Jim Irsay, the owner of the Colts, very famously. I'm not talking out of school, of course. He's dealt with addiction issues, you know, and he's been open about it. And anybody who has dealt with addiction in their own life knows that obviously, even if you're a billionaire owner of the Colts, you can't beat it. You can only hope to manage it.
Right.
But that guy, all that guy ever has wanted to do is win. You know what I mean? Like, people love to take shots at him, but it's like, you know, taking shots at someone who's sick, that's not too cool. What as a fan, all you want is a guy with a checkbook that's unlimited who is dying to win games.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right.
And so, you know, that's what Colts fans have been able to, they've had that forever. You know, and his dad was the exact opposite, completely maniacal. I'm a Baltimore Colts fan as a kid. That was my team. And Robert Irsay was the devil, and Jim Irsay's just got his own crosses to bear. But man, that guy wants to win. That's all he's ever wanted.
Mom is from Baltimore. Well, I keep saying Baltimore, but she's from Catonsville. And
okay,
the family.
Well, to anybody else, that's the same thing. You know, yeah, it's close enough.
it's the ballpark. And my grandfather was a big Orioles fan, huge Orioles fan. Constantly talked about a man who recently passed away, and Brooks Robinson. And he had such regard for the Colts.
Mm-hmm.
And he had such regard for the Orioles because he was a lifelong Baltimore resident, you know, he that was his thing. And then he moved out here and adopted the Broncos, but he always had the Orioles, and he was the most dedicated, I would say, about the Orioles. It's amazing how that generation, that was their thing.
Man.
It was America's pastime for a reason.
Yeah. And I mean that team in the 60s and 70s, you know, shit. They beat the Dodgers in 66. Then they went to three straight, 69, 70, 71. They were back in 79 and competitive every year in between. Won it all again in 83. They were the best team in 82, but didn't get in. Then they won it in 83. I mean, yeah, my, you know, I'm born in 65 and up through my freshman year of college, all I thought about with you know, the Orioles were my team too. And it was like, they're just great every year. And if you had told me in 83 when they beat the Phillies that 41 years later, I'd still be waiting for the next title, I would have laughed in your face. It wouldn't have seemed possible.
And I think it was like 89, 88 or 89, they had one of the worst starts in Major League Baseball history.
88.
88.
88. Yeah. 0 and 23.
And I still have, and I was looking through, I'm going to have to find it, but then looking through my sports old Sports Illustrated, and I found the cover that was talking about that.
That's the I
And
moved to Atlanta that year,
yeah.
and I had never paid any attention or cared on any level about the National League, so because I was just an Orioles fan. I get to Atlanta, excuse me, and I'm like, all right, well, I mean, there's a team here. I can cheer for them. It's not against the rules to decide I'm going to be a Braves fan. I mean, it's fine. I don't have a National League team, so this is fine. And so that's what I did. And the Braves started, I think, 0 and 16 that year, and the Orioles were 0 and 23. And I was just sitting there going, these are my teams? Like, what the hell? This was, I got to rethink some of this. But obviously, it turned around for the Braves pretty quickly.
Really quickly. I think it was what in 90,
91, 91, 4 years.
91. And I vividly remember those National League Championship Series with the against the Pittsburgh Pirates and Sid Bream, you know, and it just those are burned into my brain, you know. And it's weird how baseball, and it's weird, I mean, maybe this is a more of a esoteric way of looking at this, but I or philosophical, but it's like it's weird how baseball does that, because there's World Series I will never forget. I just will never forget watching them, and I have forgotten many of the last Super Bowls, believe it or not. I just
Oh yeah.
through my head.
It's a different thing. I mean, in World Series baseball, every single pitch is filled with tension. Every single pitch, not every at bat. Every pitch, when it's your team in a World Series, every pitch is life or death, man. There's nothing. My kids had never seen me watching the Orioles in the postseason until 2016. They got in, and they were literally like, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Just shut up, get out of the room. You're either watching or not." I mean, I can't sit down, and it's like, I don't watch baseball. And same thing moving to Minneapolis. I'm in an NBA town, but now I'm also back in a major league town
That's right.
because
Twins.
Nashville just has hockey and football. So, and the Twins are a team I could just hate them for 91, but I don't, you know, whatever. It's a good town. Great. You know, that was a great year. Kirby Puckett, who dislikes Kirby, blah, blah,
Yeah.
blah.
Right.
It's easy to be happy to be here, and Target Field's great. And if I'm when I went go to games, I'm cheering for the Twins as long as they're not playing the Orioles. But like, you know, Baltimore, even after all these years where they've been so far down in the dumps, when I'm at Camden Yards watching a game, which I get to every year at least once, I mean, it's a different experience. It still is. It just means, I mean, I saw Paul McCartney there a year and a half ago. And
Wow.
I'm watching Paul McCartney where the Orioles play. Now, when I was a kid, 10 minutes from that ballpark, my entire life was the Beatles and the Orioles. That's all that mattered. You know, I played Monopoly, and if I didn't get the B&O Railroad, I couldn't function. I had to have B&O because that's Beatles and Orioles. Like,
Yeah.
that was my childhood. And so watching Paul McCartney at Camden Yards, now granted, I was a kid, it was Memorial Stadium, but the point is he was right in the Orioles ballpark. I mean, that was truly my lifelong, there's no other combination of music event in a stadium or an arena that could ever come close to being as mind-blowing as that was for me.
Yeah. I mean, I had an opportunity and a crazy story to see Paul McCartney in 1993 at his New World Tour promoting the Off the Ground album. And I answered some trivia questions right at a radio station. And I got it right. It was the Beatles before they renamed the Beatles, and they were looking for a specific one. I said the Silver Beatles. And they were like, you know, you got it. And they got my information. And turns out I was too young to get the tickets.
Damn. Not cool, man.
And that's also the same year that, but I just, you know, it's amazing how things like that you remember. And I was going to tease you about Jack Morris's, you know, game seven. But I'm not going to do that because
I prefer to call that John Smoltz's game seven, but sure, go ahead.
It's good.
Hey man, that World Series though, the Black Crows went to Europe that year in 91. We left on August 1st to go to Europe, and they were 12 games out of first place. And we got back the day before the World Series started. And at no point in that 3 months did I have any idea that they had gone on a tear, that they were even in contention. I had no idea they had made the NLCS. We got off the plane in Atlanta and were just fried. I was mentally and emotionally. It's the end of that tour for the first album, which was 20 months long with really very little time off. And I got back to Atlanta and I cleared customs, get my suitcase, and there's a newspaper box. You know, you remember those? You used to get in a box, you put a quarter in. And I looked in the headline, and it was like World Series, let's do this. And I was like, let's do what? Why why is this on the front page of the AJC? And I walked over, and I mean, seeing that the Braves were in the World Series, I just stood there. I stared at this box for like 5 minutes. I was like, I don't understand. This does not make sense. Completely insane.
That's amazing. Two of the greatest pitching lineup ever is those Braves teams. It was just that's how they won. It was those Braves. It was they just had the guys. And then when they added Maddox, I think the next year, it was just even more stacked. It was just unbelievable. And Maddox was maybe the best pitcher I've ever seen as far as placement.
Definitely. I would say the best I've ever seen. I mean, I just watching him in person, especially, was just always just so mind boggling. I mean, just that's when you could really get a sense of how much he was just toying with lineups, you know, in person. He's just throwing, you know, butterflies.
Oh, yeah. It's just right on perfect on painting the corners. It just,
I might have told you this in 97, they lost the 96 World Series to the Yankees. That was Jeter's rookie year.
Yes.
Braves were up 2-0 and then went home and then lost the next four. It was gut wrenching for me. The next summer in 97, we were in New York in July and had a day off, and the Braves played at Yankee Stadium, just a regular season interleague game. And it was Maddox, and it was a day game, and a bunch of us went to the game. And Doc Gooden was actually on the Yankees that year. So it was Maddox versus Doc. And Doc had a great game. The Braves won the game. It was 1 hour, 55 minutes. Maddox threw 84 pitches, complete game.
God.
And at the around the fifth, and Yankees fans, like any fans, they're so arrogant, and they really, you know, they just assumed the Braves sucked because they'd beaten them the year before in the World Series.
Right.
And we're sitting on the third base side. We're right behind the Braves dugout. And the people we're talking to are all New York people. And after a while, they're like, is this guy always this good? And I'm like, do you ever watch the National League? And of course, they're like, no. And I was like, this is just Saturday, man. Like, this is just a day. And at the end of that game, when he got the final out, the whole stadium gave him a standing ovation. Mm-hmm. And Maddox walked off and he just doffed his cap. And everybody was just like saying, I mean, walking out of the stadium, the entire place was like, what the hell did we just see? Why isn't he on our team?
He was so good. I watched him with the Cubs. My mom was a big Cubs fan because we had out here in Denver, WGN. And the super stations, one of the two super stations. You got one in Atlanta, TBS.
Yeah.
And it was, we saw every home game. My mom loved Mark Grace. She was in love with Mark Grace, I would say. Just loved him. And we saw all these games Greg Maddux was pitching. And I knew he was a great pitcher then. I mean, he was a great pitcher with the Cubs. And then as soon as he went to the Braves, it was like, that is stacked.
He won a Cy Young with Chicago and went right to that Braves lineup with as the Cy Young holder. That's the current Cy Young winner. He joined Maddox, Avery, and Glavin. It was insane.
Oh, my God. It was just so good. Well, I said I wouldn't keep you too long, so we'll wrap up with a discussion about your new band, or I would say new. You've had it a couple of years now, but a band with Luther Dickinson and Nick Gavrick. Mm-hmm. And I saw you guys in January out here at the Gothic, a theater that I grew up two blocks away from. And I was just, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, I've been wanting to ask you about this for years, is you have, and there's just something about your drumming, and not to over compliment you, but I mean, there was something that I was hearing in your drumming that I miss in a lot of other drummers. Mm-hmm. And that thing is usually called swing. So how would you define that thing? So if someone came up to you and said, you got swing in your drumming, what do you take that as, what do you take that interpretation as?
Well, I mean, to me, drumming is first and foremost always about feel. And that's the one thing you can't really, you can fake it, I guess. You can spend a lot of time emulating someone else's feel. I play the way I play because I'm self-taught, and I started late. I didn't get my first drum kit till I was 21. I'd been obsessively looking at drummers and thinking about drumming and playing drums in my head for so long. I had a really strong sense of what I thought drummers were supposed to do. You know, like I knew immediately how to sit in a room with other musicians and give them what they were looking for. I never wanted to be a Keith Moon or a Neil Peart type of guy. They're incredible drummers, and they're mind blowing, but that's just not me. That never felt like something I could or would be interested in pursuing on any level. So, my favorite drummers, the two guys I always in my head made the most sense to me were Ringo and John Bonham. Right. And they're the two drummers that everybody on earth says they really swing. So I guess it's just innately how I felt drumming. Those are my central nervous system lit up when the Beatles or Led Zeppelin was on. Right. And there's other drummers I love dearly, you know, Charlie Watts, Stuart Copeland. I mean, there's a bunch of them, but those two guys were always my guys before I even knew what that could have possibly meant. So, and I think, you know, you can talk about my stick technique and my stick speed and all the technical crap if you want. And I come up lacking in anybody's assessment on those things. But I play music in a way that's just how I hear and feel music. It's the same thing. I don't really have a great answer for you because it's just how I do it. And it's how I've always done it. You know, the only conscious thing I ever did in the early days of Mr. Crow's Garden, which turned into the Black Crows, I made a conscious decision to, if Rich started a song, I just wanted to come in just a little slower.
Right.
Just get behind him. Just pull him back down to earth. And he would push against it. And we found a groove together in our playing. And again, we didn't talk about it. We didn't know what we were doing. Beyond just that, I'm just going to try to get a little behind you, just the tiniest nth degree.
Right.
We'll still be in time, but if we can, it's in that little space, you know, a metronome goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, you know, just perfect time. And a backbeat groove is just going to pull an nth of a degree back on that in a way that, again, the more you talk about it, the sillier it sounds. So it's just hard to get words out to explain to someone who's not a drummer, but yeah. It's just a feel thing. And it's my approach has always been, well, if I'm going to be accused of anything, it's not going to be he's speeding up. It's the simplest way I can say it.
Well, and the reason I ask you that is that that your show at the Gothic this last January, I noticed, and maybe it's just because I'm so attuned to your drumming specifically, being as following it as long as I have, mm-hmm. is that I hear a thing with you that I don't hear with other people. And maybe that right. you're right. It comes through because you're self-taught. And I'm a self-taught musician. There's a lot of people I know are self-taught musicians. And there seems to be a thing with self-taught musicians that is less meterable and more right. you can hear the feel. I guess that's the best way to put it. You can hear what they're feeling. And I think what I was hearing up on the stage was really good. Ever since I saw your concert back mm-hmm. in January, I've been telling people, go watch it because it flows. There's a groove to it that you kind of get sucked up in. And I don't know if you could hear it from the audience, but every time Luther would shout you out, everyone would go mad and cheer for you. And I'm sure there were some people in the audience. This was a North Mississippi All-Star. They were the headliner.
Yeah.
I'm sure that some right. of them didn't know who you were, but everyone cheered when Luther pointed you out. And I think I was feeling that myself, not to, get too, complimentary, but it's just, that's what I was feeling. And if I'm going to tell people to go see Bagman, this is exactly what I'm going to say. Go for the groove, go for the songwriting. And it really was what I thought was a great, great kind of show. And your music's on iTunes and wherever you get your streaming right now. And I'd say go right. out and get it because I really, really enjoyed what I saw.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, that's all great. You know, we're if there's any point to Bagman at all, it's what you just said. Just go have a good time.
Yep.
I mean, that's not a band that is designed to take over the world by a long shot. We're literally we have such a fun time playing together, and we just wanted to do that. We just wanted to get together and write some songs and see where we could take them without putting a whole lot of extraneous thought into it. And there's not that I have a problem with bands who have a plan. I mean, I'm all for it, but that's not what this band is. It is about exactly what you just said, which is just go there and have a good time and shake your hips a little bit, man. There's a good groove and it's funky and it rocks and it's just all the things that make people feel good. If it's, if we're doing our job, that's what it is.
That's true. And that was a cold gig and not based on what you were playing. It was cold outside.
That was definitely chilly.
Everyone was saying the same thing, it's been great once again to talk to you, Steve. I never want you to overstay, have to feel like you're overstaying, and I really do appreciate this. You don't need to come on, but you've always graced me with your presence, and I really appreciate it.
Of course.
So
man.
So tell the people, like if there's people listening up in the upper Midwest, what you're doing right now on the radio.
Well, I host the KQRS morning show. KQRS is a classic rock station in Minneapolis. It's been around for 60 plus years. It's a great, it's a old guard rocker station. That's been a big part of the scene here for as long as there's been a scene here. And I took over the morning show last January, 6 to 10 every morning. And then I still have a syndicated show on nights, coast to coast on a bunch of classic rock shows called Steve Gorman Rocks. So I'm doing a whole lot of radio these days. I'm up early. I miss my Timberwolves games, especially when they're out west. And but, making up for it.
Yeah.
So I'm on the radio in the morning, and then my syndicated show airs at night on a bunch of stations.
All right. Well, that's my friend Steve Gorman. You can catch him up there in Minneapolis and the Twin Cities, and also catch him with Bagman. Do you have any gigs coming up in the future?
We're here in St. Paul. We're playing Chicago and then in St. Paul, Minneapolis in June, but we got nothing until then.
Okay.
This isn't a full-time gig. It's not even a part-time gig. It's every now and again, when we all have a weekend with nothing on the schedule, let's get together and play and have a great time, which is which is why if you see a Bagman show, you're going to see three really happy guys on stage.
That's very true. That really came through, particularly in that game.
Yeah,
so
we're never going to, there's never going to be, oh, that's too many shows. I mean, that's not a possibility with as busy as the three of us are with all the other stuff we're doing.
That's very true. All right. Well, thank you, Steve. And this has been another another Mortcast on CSG. I'm going to be back in a couple days with another episode. Goodbye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.